talk about the significance of the effect on property values to abutters.
Could you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Jim Chalmers. My expertise is in the area of real estate and appraisal, and I've been looking at studying property value effects of projects of all sorts pretty much steadily since the 1970s. I've been working here for the last 2.5 years doing research on a broadly focused study, looking simply at the effects of high voltage transmission lines on property values in New Hampshire. That study is independent of Northern Pass. It's simply a broad-based study asking the question, what has been the effect of high voltage transmission lines on the purchase and sale of properties in New Hampshire? And that study has four major components. It surveys the professional literature, which is extensive on this topic. But then most importantly, it undertakes three New Hampshire specific studies. The first of those is a set of case studies. This is a study of 58 sales of properties that either abut or are in fact crossed by a high voltage transmission line right away in New Hampshire. Then there are 13 what we call subdivision studies, which are studies which look at the sale of lots, and these would be raw land, unimproved lots in subdivisions where some of the lots are either crossed by or abut a transmission line easement, and other lots do not. It's a very revealing environment in which to see if what the effect of the transmission line might be, as it's not confused with the kind of house that's built on the lot. And then the fourth initiative is looking at some multiple listing service data on the length of time that properties are on the market. Days on market is the measure. And also looking at the ratio of sale prices to list prices for properties at different distances from transmission lines. The results of those studies are basically very consistent. And the implication for the Northern Pass project is that it's my opinion, and the implication of the research is that there will be no widespread, consistent property value effects of the project. There's an exception to that. There will be, the studies have identified a unique set of attributes of a property. Essentially, what they amount to is properties that are very heavily impacted by a transmission line corridor, where the project may in fact increase the likelihood that those properties will sustain some kind of a value impact. The number of properties that have those attributes, however, is very small in this project. It's a handful, maybe a dozen properties. And those are very localized, very property specific, and will have no discernible effects on local or regional real estate markets.
Thank you, Jim.
All right. There's a new topic, which is really about another renewable source and solar. I'm going to read it largely the way it's written in three parts here. Why is New Hampshire not into the solar market the way its neighbors to the south and west are, in Massachusetts and Vermont? What are the deterrents or obstacles to solar becoming a more significant part of the mix, in your view? And this may be a very specific question to the person who's writing it, but what would it take to become involved in the purchase of solar panels? You may or may not have useful information to offer on that.
So on the first topic of, you know, why hasn't solar grown as quickly in New Hampshire as it has in some other states like Massachusetts, I would say New Hampshire has taken a measured approach to encouraging solar development. There is subsidy that's provided to solar developers, that's referred to as net metering, that is really a key to making a solar installation economic. Some states have had a very high adoption because they, in essence, don't have a limit as to the extent of that subsidy. So Massachusetts, for example, has seen a proliferation of solar development because they're allowing that net metering subsidy to be available to a large number of developers. New Hampshire, on the other hand, has taken a bit more measured approach. While we allow net metering, we do provide a subsidy. The legislature, in its wisdom, several years ago, in essence, put a cap on the net metering subsidy that was going to allow while this technology was in its infancy. We are approaching that cap, and some utilities like ours have now just recently hit the cap. So the growth has been a bit more modest, and I think it was due to the way the legislation was structured. Now, the real issue becomes, you know, how much of a subsidy do you want to provide to solar? And are other customers who don't have solar panels willing to pick up that subsidy? So for every dollar of subsidy that's paid out as a result of net metering, either a business or another residential customer who doesn't have a solar panel have to pay that. And the question is, what's the right balance between promoting an exciting technology, one that clearly has part of our energy mix, in the subsidy? How far do you go? And there are several subsidies available to solar developers. You know, there's a federal tax credit, there's a renewable energy credit, there is funding through New Hampshire's Clean Energy Fund. So those are three subsidies. This fourth, which is the net metering subsidy, is the one that really finalizes the economics and allows it to work. So I know there's discussion right now within the New Hampshire legislature to relax that cap so that this industry continues to grow in a measured, affordable way without putting too large a burden on other customers. So, you know, I think the subsidy structure in New Hampshire, my own estimation, is about right. It's not inhibiting the growth, it's allowing it to be done in a measured way. You know, I've read recently in the industry publications that from a solar developer's perspective, New Hampshire rates very highly with respect to the things it is doing to promote solar. I think it was the fourth highest rated state in the union. And that seems odd for a state like New Hampshire, you know, as compared to a state that, you know, is in a sunnier climate. So, you know, my view is New Hampshire's done it well. I think the legislature will take a look at that and determine how far they want to go. And the second question, I'm sorry, Commissioner.
Yeah, it's really a question about how one would get into purchasing solar panels. There are installers all over the state.
Yes, there are installers and developers statewide who could better answer that. You know, our obligation as a utility, in essence, is to allow for the interconnection of those installations to our grid. Because back to the earlier point, there needs to be a reliable backup for instances where the sun's not shining.
All right, the sheet I have in my hand has a question at the bottom, but what is really a comment at the top that I'm going to turn into a question. And that is that anyone who's driven in southern Quebec on the way to Montreal has seen the transmission lines that are along the road, cross the road, various places. How will the view of the towers in this state compare to what you see along the road to Montreal?
Yeah, so just an interesting point on this. You know, I talked earlier about Hydro-Quebec and the fact that, you know, they have a large generation fleet, hydroelectric fleet. One of the things that has to happen for this project to work is they need to build another transmission line from northern Quebec down to the U.S. border to interconnect with Northern Pass. That's something that Hydro-Quebec is pursuing. They'll be paying for it. It will be an all overhead projects similar to the ones that, that you've seen. I'd say there are significant differences in, from that project and what we're proposing here in New Hampshire, and I think the video did a nice job of highlighting some of the things that we are doing to address aesthetic concerns. You know, we've now put 60 miles underground, and we selected those areas based upon feedback from New Hampshire stakeholders. What are the areas that we heard from consistently from stakeholders across the state should we be addressing? So that was that's a big difference. You know, as I said earlier, we're working now at a design level. We are actually changing the structure designs and using, in many instances, what's referred to as a monopole structure to replace the lattice structures that you would see north of the border. Lattice structures tend to be more imposing. They look like large erector sets. They have four legs, as the video showed. A monopole looks more like a conventional telephone pole. It's a single pole and it holds all three conductors. There's obviously an additional cost in doing that, but it is another step that we're taking in our portion of the line to address New Hampshire concerns. And then finally, I'll say, as far as location, you know, the changes we've made to move the line from the western part of Coos County to the eastern part of Coos County were driven, in essence, to address the aesthetic issue. So we're trying to demonstrate a real sensitivity to that question. We know it's top of mind for many in New Hampshire, and we're working really hard to address it. Ken?
One addition to that is Hydro-Québec also operates a system that is at 765 kV. They're one of the few utilities in North America that do that. So that may be part of the, again, not seeing the structures that the person's speaking to. So that would be a much larger structure because of the higher voltage. In New England, we operate a system that's predominantly at 345 kV, so approximately half the voltage. That does not mean it's half the height, but it is considerably lower height than the 765 system.
Yeah. So back to Mr. Bowe's earlier answer, the National Electric Safety Code dictates the height of the tower. One of the key drivers of that is the voltage of the line. The higher the voltage, the taller the structure.
The second question on the sheet I'm going to read is as close to the way it's written as I can, and you may need to do some interpretation. Why does Eversource not consider a lower voltage line to match the current footprint of electrical transmission in New Hampshire? And what voltage line would match the current footprint in terms of tower height?
Okay. I'm going to defer that to Mr. Bowes.
So the existing Hydro-Québec line is 450 kV DC. So one of the design parameters we looked at was exactly that. So as part of the evaluation process, we did select a lower voltage, in this case 320 kV DC, to do just that, to make the structures lower and more compact than the initial HVDC line through New Hampshire. This is also, in comparison, approximately the same as the existing 345 kV AC system that is used throughout New England. So a couple design considerations were done. Now, the existing right-of-way that we're talking about, much of the part of the North Country, is at 115 kV AC. That is considerably lower voltage than the 320 kV DC. And the real issue we went to, the higher voltage for the DC line, is the amount of capacity needed, the amount of transport for over 1,000 megawatts. That is not capable on a 115 kV line, which would then have the same structure dimensions and heights.
Right. And importantly, once we've gotten to Franklin and we convert it to 345 kV AC, that's a consistent voltage throughout New England. The bulk transmission system that controls power flows, long distance power flows, large capacity around New England generally is 345. So it is a consistent voltage once you've gotten to Franklin.
We have a couple of questions related to reliability, but before I do that, I'm going to circle back to a question that was on, there were two questions on one sheet, and they were unrelated. And this question is really directed to the subcommittee. And the question is, why doesn't the subcommittee have any questions? There are probably different answers for different people. I'll give mine, and I'll ask some of the other members of the subcommittee to weigh in. There are a few reasons. One is that we receive the full application from the applicant, and I've forgotten the exact number of binders, but I think it might be 17 binders constitutes one application, and we get it on a thumb drive, and we have the opportunity to read it at our leisure. I cannot tell you, I certainly would not represent that I have even read half of what's been given to me, but I've looked at a lot of it, and I've looked to see what's there, and looked to see what are the things I'm going to need to concentrate on. So we've had the opportunity to look at this application for many months now. Second, this isn't the only time we have the applicant and others in front of us. We will see them again four more times through hearings like this. But more significant, they're going to have to come in front of us at a hearing on the merits of their application. And they're going to have to make detailed presentations and be subjected to questions from others who are participating in this matter. They'll answer questions from us at that time on the record. Their witnesses will be under oath. So we have many opportunities to interact with the applicant throughout this process. Those are probably the two major reasons why I prefer to step back at events like this and allow the public's questions to have the feature role in an event like this. Others want to weigh in? Please.
I think I'd echo that. I mean, part of the reason for being here is we obviously want to hear from the applicant, we want to hear from the public, and we've been looking at this for quite a long time, and we're seeing a voluminous amount of documents. Questions are forming even as through the presentation that we've had tonight, and I might very well end up having some more questions if they're not answered. But I think primarily we want to hear from everyone in the room.
I would echo that. I look at this primarily as a listening session. I'm here to learn more about the project, but mostly to hear about your concerns. From that, I develop my own list of questions. I have a number of them that may ask tonight, or they may get answered as we go along. And if they're not answered tonight, they certainly will be answered at the time we have the full hearings. So just because I have no questions at the beginning of the process here tonight doesn't mean that we won't have a lot of questions for the applicant.
All right, the next two questions, or the next two sheets, have a number of questions that are related to reliability on both sides of the border. Starting on our side of the border is a question about what kind of redundancy of the transmission lines will be in place should there be something that happens along the line in New Hampshire. And I guess I would add to that what kinds of protections are in place to prevent problems or damage to the line here in New Hampshire.
Okay. Defer that to Mr. Bose.
So this application is for a single line. So it is, there's a single point of failure along that line. So there is not by itself redundancy built in. But in the design itself, there are many things that are taken into consideration, including, you know, impacts from external factors, such as trees off the right-of-way and within the right-of-way, so that will be managed over the life of the project. The design itself is to a higher class of construction than normally. It's called Class B construction, which means that it is built to withstand more extreme conditions as we are starting to experience more and more as the climate changes. So both wind and ice loading are at a higher level than the traditional construction techniques. For the portions that are underground, there'll be a protective cap for portions of it in the public way. So a concrete encased, as well as it'll be clearly identified on street maps. So the chance of an external excavator hitting the underground line, it'll be clearly marked both on the call or dig safe maps, as well as with markers laid into the trench area itself. So those are some of the things that are done to enhance the design and operation of the line to make it the most reliable it can be.
Mr. Munz?
Yeah, I would also add, as part of the design of any project like this, you need to submit an application to the independent system operator, and the project needs to be evaluated for its impact on the system and other generators and other transmission elements in the system under all types of system conditions, various loads, weather patterns, and so forth. You are evaluated and issued a certificate that says you're allowed to build this project. It will do no harm to the system. And oftentimes that, what's called an I-39 evaluation, specifies some other system upgrades that you need to do. Those, basically, we've gotten through that process with the ISO. We're waiting for the official review. We've identified those upgrades, and those are included in the application, and we would intend to build them as part of the project.
Reliability north of the border is the subject of this sheet. The sheet says, and I guess I'll ask you to comment on the first part before following up with the question. It says here that when Northern Pass was introduced, there was a chart on either the Northern Pass or the Hydro-Quebec website that showed that Hydro-Quebec might not be able to guarantee electricity during the three winter months. This says that that chart has disappeared from the website. Can you comment on that or verify that at all?
I can. So I earlier referred to the three-state RFP, and I talked about Hydro-Quebec's delivery commitment. One of the things that they have committed to is to deliver 6 terawatt hours of electricity, which is a lot of electricity, to New England, into Deerfield, New Hampshire, during the winter months and during the hours that New England needs it most. So that is their formal commitment now. And if we are selected to, under that request for proposal, that will be a binding commitment on Hydro-Quebec to, in essence, address the issue. And they will be commercially and contractually obligated to deliver the power when we need it most, which is during those critical on-peak hours during the winter months.
I think then you may have answered the question as it followed up on the premise, which is that if there is extremely high demand due to extreme weather in Quebec, will there be a problem with their transmission of the full 1090 commitment?
Now, there is no exception to the delivery commitment that they're making. So it exists irrespective of what system conditions are in Canada. And if you look at the history of Hydro-Quebec and the deliveries they've made to New England, they've been delivering large amounts of power to this region for decades. When they have a formal delivery obligation under a contract, they very, very rarely are in a position where they can't meet that obligation. Almost universally, they've been in a position to deliver it even during the coldest winters in the highest demand times in Quebec.
All right, the last question that I have in all these sheets relates to your right to use land you do not own. I'm gonna read it as it's written, and you answer however you feel is appropriate.
Okay.
How is it legal to drill under land that you do not own or have a right of way across? And there's a reference to the Washburn Family Trust in Pittsburgh and Clarksville.
Okay. So that's a particular area in northern Coos County where we've made a commitment to, in essence, have underground construction under the public right of way. We think we, as a utility, are entitled to use the public way for that purpose. Our belief is based upon centuries, over 100 years of legal precedent here in the state of New Hampshire, standing for the premise that running utilities such as this to transmit electricity is an appropriate use of the public way. There is a currently pending lawsuit on this very issue. We're in the process of seeking the court's resolution of that. We feel very strongly about the legal basis for our ability to do so, and hopefully the court's going to address that expeditiously. But it's really a right that is granted to utilities, and it's based in decades of precedent.
All right, I have no other green sheets. Is there a question that someone thinks they submitted that I didn't, at least in some way, deal with? All right,